This is not the and within us, but between us. It's the one that says, I can listen and understand what you have to say, and you can listen to and understand what I have to say. Stacy found the you-me and helpful in her quest to find her birth mother. Stacy's adoptive mother, Joyce, argued that Stacy's search was sure to be fruitless and painful. Stacy avoided engaging in an argument over whether or not that was true by using and to embrace both stories. You might be right. It may be that all my efforts won't turn up anything, and even if I do find her, I might be disappointed. She might not want to see me at all. And it's still important to me to try. Here's why. When Joyce said, after all we've done to love you and raise you, what could you possibly need that your birth mother could provide? Stacy responded with some me-me ands and you-me ands. If this sounds complex, it is. And that's why Stacy's response was so constructive and effective. It sounds like my search is really hard for you. You're the best mother in the world and the only mother I'll ever have. That's not going to change. This is hard for me, too, because it's hard for me to see you feeling hurt like this. Sometimes I think I'm just being selfish or ungrateful. At the same time, I have questions that I really want to answer. I hope we can keep talking about what this means to each of us as I begin to pursue this. Stacy was able to assert herself without invalidating the power and importance of her mother's concerns. No matter how good you get at reframing, the single most important rule about managing the interaction is this. You can't move the conversation in a more positive direction until the other person feels heard and understood. And they won't feel heard and understood until you've listened. When the other person becomes highly emotional, listen and acknowledge. When they say their version of the story is the only version that makes sense, paraphrase what you're hearing. Ask them some questions about why they think this. If they level accusations against you, before defending yourself, try to understand their view. Whenever you feel overwhelmed or unsure how to proceed, remember that it is always a good time to listen. We often assume that the listener is playing a passive role in the conversation, but that's not necessarily true. You can use listening to direct the conversation, but sometimes it does require persistence. Consider this telephone conversation between Harpreet and his wife Monisha. Monisha is a sales representative for a large pharmaceutical company and spends a significant amount of time on the road. The distance highlights what has been a tense issue throughout their relationship. Okay, well, I better get some sleep. I've got a big presentation first thing in the morning.
So I'll see you on Thursday?
Yeah, Thursday night. I should be home probably about 7.
Okay. Sleep tight. I love you.
Good night. See you Thursday. Harpreet hangs up hurt and frustrated. He complains she never tells him that she loves him, and whenever he brings it up, she says something like, "You know I love you, so why do I need to say it all the time?" This issue is obviously important to Harpreet. And for that reason, it makes sense that he should be persistent in raising it with Monisha. But many people think that being persistent means asserting your view. In other words, that Harpreet should just repeat himself. No. You have to find a way to be persistent while remembering that you are in a two-way conversation. Persistence in a difficult conversation means remaining as stubbornly interested in hearing the other person's views as you are in asserting your own. In thinking through the three conversations, Harpreet began to be curious about why Monisha reacted the way she did. In their next conversation, Harpreet decided that his purpose was mainly to listen, to ask questions, and to try to understand how Monisha experienced this issue.
When I say that I love you, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking, okay, he's waiting for me to say it back to him, so it makes me not want to say it then, because I feel pressured into it. Besides, you know I love you.
Well, sometimes I do feel confident that you love me, but sometimes I feel less sure. When you say that I know, how are you thinking I would know?
Well, I'm still with you, aren't I?
That's a pretty low standard. Besides, my parents stayed together for years after they stopped loving each other. Maybe that's why I sometimes feel nervous about this.
I guess I have the opposite experience. My parents were crazy about each other. They're always saying these sappy things in front of us. I thought it was embarrassing. It just seems like if you really love each other, you don't have to say it all the time. You can just show it.
Show it how?
Well, I don't know, like being kind to each other. You know, like when I dropped everything and flew to Phoenix that weekend your mom was sick. I did it because I knew how hard it was for you. I wanted to be there to help. Harpreet and Monisha have some distance to go. But simply by listening through the retorts and arguments for the feelings and stories, Harpreet is helping them to have a much more interesting and constructive conversation on a topic that is hard for both of them. Reframing and listening involve leading the conversation in the direction you want it to go. These tools are powerful, and most of your conversations will call on both. Sometimes, though, they're not enough. No matter how well you listen, no matter how many times you reframe, the other person will continue to interrupt, attack, or dismiss you. Every time you begin to get somewhere, they have another reason why the problem isn't a problem after all. Or perhaps they're acting upset, but each time you ask about it, they say, "Oh, no, no, I'm fine. I'm not upset at all." At times like these, naming the dynamic can help. You put on the table as a topic for discussion what you see happening in the conversation itself. In a sense, you are acting as your own conversation doctor, diagnosing the problem and prescribing a way back to health. These kinds of diagnoses and suggestions sound like this.
I've noticed that we keep running out of time whenever we start talking about this. Maybe we should designate an hour when we can both really focus on this and address it then. I've tried to say what I was thinking 3 times now, and each time you've started talking over me. I don't know whether you're aware that it's happening, but I'm finding it frustrating. If there's something important about what you're saying that I'm not understanding, please share it, and then I want to be able to finish what I'm saying.
Here's what I'm noticing. I ask you if you're feeling hurt by what I said, and you say, "No, no, no, of course not, I'm not that kind of person." But then you keep acting toward me in ways that people act when they're hurt or mad at me. At least that's how I'm seeing this. It seems to me the best thing to do is to try to figure out what I'm doing that might be upsetting to you. Otherwise, I don't think we're going to get anywhere.
Hang on a second. Several times now, when I've said the things that are important to me, you've gotten very angry to the point where I feel threatened. I don't know what's causing your response. If you're upset, I'm interested to hear why. If you're trying to intimidate me into changing my mind, it won't work. I really do want to know what's upsetting you, and I want us to find a way to talk about it that doesn't feel intimidating to me.
Naming the dynamic between you can be enormously helpful in clearing the air. It draws what you are each really thinking and feeling but not saying onto the table for honest discussion. And it can stop frustrating interactions in their tracks. Often, the other person is not aware that they're doing something that is upsetting to you. However, it does take the conversation off the substance, and sometimes it can escalate tension. So naming the dynamic is probably best thought of as something to try when nothing else has worked. Often, sorting out the 3 conversations and bringing to light the heart of the matter for each person clears up the issues between you. But not always. You've come a long way in understanding each other's stories and untangling what's happened. You have a better grasp on the feelings involved. But at the end of the day, you still need to decide how to go forward together, and you may not agree on how to do that. This is the time for problem solving. Fundamentally, problem solving consists of gathering information and testing your perceptions, creating options that would meet both sides' primary concerns, and where you can't, trying to find fair ways to resolve the difference. Difficult conversations require a certain amount of compromise and mutual accommodation to the other's needs. If you find problem-solving difficult and anxiety-producing, it may be because you are focused on persuading them. Those caught in this trap struggle like a fish on a hook, desperately trying to satisfy the seemingly insatiable demands of the other and reach some reasonable agreement on how to move forward. And no wonder. This frame gives the other side total control. Unless and until they are satisfied, you must continue to struggle. Describing the pattern this way illuminates its flaw. There are 2 people involved, and there will be no agreement unless both concur. You need to persuade them no more and no less than they need to persuade you. Thus, you always have the option to turn the tables, to invite them to persuade you and insist that they do. As long as you are open to persuasion and prepared, if absolutely necessary, to live with no agreement, you can do this as firmly as you would like. I understand that you are determined to have your article reviewed this week, and I'm still not persuaded I should spend my vacation doing it. For many people, realizing that they don't have to agree brings a sense of great liberation, relief, and empowerment. Henry had planned this weekend away with friends months ago. He worked extra hours all week, finishing up the new displays and work schedules. It was Friday morning when Henry's boss, Rosaria, approached him in the back room. "Hank, I got big problems with this supplier. We've got to get it figured out over the weekend, so that we're sure we got the stock to handle the holiday rush next month," she explained. "I'm really sorry, because I know you had plans this weekend, but I do need you to stay. I'm sure you can reschedule with your friends, right?" Rather than explode or argue, Henry decided to learn more about why Rosaria was so concerned. As Henry and Rosaria sorted through their stories, they discovered that they had quite different assumptions about their relationship with the supplier in question. Henry believed that even if they ran into problems down the road, the supplier would work with them to rush their order overnight. Rosaria had had too many bad experiences with suppliers over the years to believe that anything other than getting it right the first time would ensure that the holidays would go smoothly. Divergent views are often rooted in one or more conflicting assumptions or hypotheses. If these can be identified, then you can discuss what would constitute a fair test of which assumption is empirically valid, or to what extent it is valid. Henry suggested that they call the supplier and ask about the availability of the stock in question, and whether someone would be willing to work with them if they ran into problems in the coming weeks. Rosaria wanted to make sure they asked a series of what-if questions and established a personal relationship with someone on the other end who could take responsibility for making it work. To be persuasive, of course, such a test needs to satisfy both parties that it is fair and adequate. Here are some ways to craft such a test. Say what is still missing. As you struggle with conflicting perceptions and conclusions, each of you needs to say unambiguously where the other person's story still doesn't make sense to you. As you follow their reasoning, what's missing that would make their version make sense? So Henry might say, "I think I understand now why stock problems caused us to lose money last year. It does seem that we need to get it sorted out early. Yet, right now we've got a 30-day head start on the problem, so I guess I'm not understanding why this weekend is going to make the difference." Say what would persuade you. Being open to persuasion is a powerful stance to have. It allows you to be honest and firm about your current views and to listen to theirs. "Based on my understanding, it seems to me that my assistant manager, Bill, has the training to do the inventory this weekend, giving me a head start on the problem next week. Is your understanding different? Maybe you've got concerns about Bill that would be persuasive to me." You can also ask what, if anything, would persuade them. "I've offered a number of what seem to me good reasons why it doesn't make sense for me to cancel my plans and work this weekend. Yet, you remain adamant that I stay. Is there a reason I haven't heard? If not, I'm wondering if there's anything I could say that would persuade you otherwise. And if so, what would it be?" Finally, you can ask their advice. "Help me understand how you would feel and how you might think about the situation if you were in my shoes. What would you do? Why? Could you imagine a way of staying that would not end up making it more likely that something like this would happen again?" Our experience has been that people who understand that persuasion must be a two-way street rarely find themselves in situations like this. Their reputation for not being a pushover gains them both general respect and a wider berth from those who might otherwise be inclined to take advantage. Let's come back to your neighbors with the barking dog. When you finally raise the issue, you learn that they feel the dog's barking is important for security reasons, and that the reason he's left outside at night is that they fear he might accidentally hurt the new baby, whom he adores. This makes sense to you, and you are able nonetheless to share how frustrating and exhausting it is for you to be kept awake. When it comes time to figure out what to do about it, you may get stuck. Your answer, get rid of the dog, isn't so appealing to them, and their answer, wear earplugs or close the windows, seems ridiculous to you. Many difficult situations are amenable to creative solutions that meet most of everyone's needs, but that may not be obvious and may take some effort to find. This calls for determined joint brainstorming. I wonder if we can work to find a creative way to meet both interests here. What do you think? Are you willing to try? Odds are, persistence will pay off. Brainstorming might yield some useful ideas. For example, your son might spend time with the neighbor's dog, so the dog gets more exercise and attention during this busy period with the new baby. This might also meet some of your son's interests in getting a dog of his own. Or your neighbors might decide to get a second dog to keep the first one company, or to bring the dog indoors after 10 p.m. and close the door to the baby's room. Or perhaps they'll ask you to call when the barking starts to bother you, so they can address the problem right away, and you won't spend another sleepless night. What's important is that you both recognize that if you are going to continue to live next door, you need to work together to find a solution that satisfies everyone, you, them, and the dog. Generally, the best way to manage conflict in a way that safeguards a relationship is to look for standards or fair principles to guide a resolution, rather than trying to haggle with or intimidate the other person. If you can't find a creative way to solve the problem, ask what standards of fairness should apply and why. In the case of the dog, there may be a local ordinance pertaining to noise, or a method other dog owners in the neighborhood have used to keep their pooches quiet. Industry or local practices, legal precedents, and ethical principles all offer ways to settle the matter without anyone having to back down or lose face. One dynamic to remember at this stage of a difficult conversation is the tendency we all have to believe that our way of doing things is the right way. This can lead us to ascribe the problem to something wrong with the way they are, and to suggest a solution that boils down to doing it our way. Look, if you just change, there wouldn't be a problem. The frustration is understandable, but the argument is not persuasive. Both the challenge and the spice of relationships is in people's differences. Occasional frustration is the price of admission. And as we've noted, no relationship will endure if one party always gives in to the other. A good resolution will usually require each party to accommodate somewhat to the other's differences, or perhaps to reciprocate, going one way on some issues and the other way on others. This is the principle of mutual caretaking. Clearly, though, not every conflict can be resolved by mutual agreement. Sometimes, even after highly skilled communication, you and the other person will simply fail to come up with an option that works for both of you. Then you're faced with a decision. Should you accept less than you want, or should you accept the consequences of not agreeing? Let's come back to Henry and Rosaria. Rosaria's the boss. Henry's a valuable employee. If they can't arrive at a solution to the problem of whether Henry will work the weekend, then they each face some choices. Each needs to think about what they will do if they can't arrive at a solution together. If you're going to walk away without agreeing, you need two things. First, you need to explain why you are walking away. What interests and concerns are not met by the solutions you've been discussing? Let's imagine that Henry decides to take the weekend off, despite Rosaria's continued insistence that he stay. Rather than just storming out, Henry should be clear about his feelings, his interests, and his choices. He might say, "Rosaria, I'm really sorry. I want very much to be a good employee and to help out when I can. Normally, I'm happy to work weekends and nights. I hope you've seen that in the past. It's simply a matter of notice. I feel bad about leaving you in the lurch. At the same time, these plans are really important to me, and I gave you plenty of notice and worked hard all week so I could go away. So I don't like the choice, but given the choice, I'm going to go." Now Henry needs a second thing, a willingness to accept the consequences. He may return on Monday and find that he no longer has a job. If he can live with that, or indeed prefers that, then going off with his friends makes sense. And as often as not, he may return to find Rosaria is both unhappy and more respecting of him and his time. Perhaps she will even apologize, or ask to talk about how to avoid such situations in the future. If Henry can't live with the possibility of losing his job, then his best choice is probably to work the weekend. He'll feel disappointed that he didn't get to spend the time with his friends, but he'll know he handled the conversation skillfully and made a wise choice in the end. Most difficult conversations are not in actuality a single conversation. They're a series of exchanges and explorations that happen over time. Assuming that Henry and Rosaria work things out this time, there will be plenty of other issues that arise between them. Work demands will continue to be high, and they'll have to work together to figure out how to balance this with Henry's personal commitments. You and your neighbor will have to try out having your son care for the dog, or letting the dog inside at night, and see how it goes. Michael and Jack, the friends arguing over the brochure at the beginning of the program, will need to find ways to repair their friendship and explore whether and how to work together in the future. And however it goes, you should have follow-up conversations to check in and, if necessary, look for new ways to cope.
Putting it all together. Jack would like to take another crack at a conversation with Michael.
I thought that once we got that brochure out of the way, things would settle down between us.
But months later, Michael remains distant and the friendship has become awkward. Jack knows he should talk to Michael, but about what? Jack believes that the bottom line is this. Michael was just being a jerk. The first step in preparing for such a conversation is walking through the three conversations. When Jack sat down and walked himself through the three conversations, making notes to himself about how Michael might be seeing things and what they've each contributed to the problem, he made a few discoveries along the way. He realized that Michael probably didn't know that he had put aside other things and had worked through the night. He saw the ways in which he had contributed to the problem by not raising his feelings with Michael at the time or as soon as the brochure was done. This reinforced his determination to change this contribution and raise his feelings now.
Rethinking my assumptions about what happened succeeded in shaking my confidence that I was right and that the problem here was Michael. Probably the biggest thing I realized was just that I didn't really understand this at all from Michael's perspective. I'm willing to try.
Shaking your confidence may seem like a funny way to prepare for a conversation. But as a result, Jack is more open to hearing what Michael has to say, more curious about learning what he doesn't know, like about Michael's intentions, or what Michael thinks Jack has contributed. And in an important sense, Jack is more confident. Accepting his own role in the problem has helped him to feel more grounded rather than less. While he's no longer sure that his story is right and that Michael's is wrong, Jack is absolutely certain that each of their stories matters. The second step in having a difficult conversation is to check your purposes and decide whether to raise it. Most important, Jack feels more secure that raising these issues to express himself and to learn is a good thing to try, regardless of how Michael reacts.
At first, as I considered whether to raise this issue again, I thought, well, what if Michael thinks it's not important or just brushes it off? Then I'll feel foolish or like I failed. I played with the idea of not raising things, but I would have been running away rather than making a clear-headed choice to let go. So I wanted to raise it, but I was a little nervous. Then I remembered the advice about not trying to control the other person's reaction. I'm raising it because I think it's important, and I'm going to do it as well as I can, and if Michael isn't interested in talking, or if he's not open, well, at least I tried, and I can feel good that I stuck up for myself.
What follows is parts of the conversation between Jack and Michael as it might realistically go, with one difference. To put what Jack is doing well and less well into higher relief, we're giving him a consultant to coach him when he gets stuck. We're also going to give Jack the chance to start and stop and to start over if things aren't going quite right. The third step in having a difficult conversation is to start from the third story. Here is Jack's first try at getting started and the result.
Listen, Michael, say what you will, but the problem on that brochure was that after all the work I did, you treated me badly, and you know it.
The problem on that project was that I had the poor judgment to use you in the first place. I'll never make that mistake again.
Okay, cut. This isn't going right.
What went wrong?
I don't know. He didn't react very well.
Well, notice that you began the conversation from inside your story.
I should have started from the third story. That's right. Let me start over. Michael, I've been thinking a lot about what happened between us on the brochure. I know I found the experience frustrating, and I suspect that you probably did as well. What's most worrisome to me is that it feels like maybe it's affected our friendship. I wonder whether we could talk about that. I'd like to understand better what was happening for you and how you felt about working together. And I'd also like to share what I found upsetting.
Well, Jack, the problem is that you're just not careful enough and then can't admit it when you make a mistake. It really made me angry when you started making excuses.
Okay, he's attacking me again. I thought if I started from the third story, he was supposed to be nicer.
Well, Michael's reaction wasn't nearly as confrontational as your first try. You're actually off to a pretty good start. You did a great job of beginning from the third story. Remember, persistence. Michael's not immediately going to understand that you're trying to have a learning conversation. You have to be prepared for him to be somewhat defensive.
And say what if he attacks me?
Well, he's already into his story. So the best thing you can do for the conversation at this point is to listen from a real stance of curiosity. Ask questions, and remember to pay special attention to the feelings behind the words.
The fourth step in having a difficult conversation is to explore their story and yours.
So you felt that I was making excuses. Could you say a little more about that?
The truth is, Jack, you shouldn't have argued with me about the chart. You should have just redone the brochure.
So your thinking was that since the graph was off, it was up to me to correct it and reprint the brochures. It sounds like when I questioned that, that was really frustrating for you.
Yeah, it was frustrating. I had the client breathing down my neck, already less than happy with us.
Really? What was going on?
Because she thought this photograph in one of the other publications was the wrong one. It wasn't, but you just don't argue at times like that. That's what really frustrated me, Jack. You don't seem to understand that the customer is always right.
So the client was already looking for things to be unhappy about.
It sure felt that way. And if there was something you were going to screw up, the revenue chart was the first thing she was going to notice. Her investors are already unhappy with some of her recent decisions. Yes, the chart was only off by a small amount, and it's not something we'd always rerun. But in this case, given the situation, it was something that we had to get just right.
I didn't realize some of this background. It sounds like there was a lot going on for you during all of this. Okay, time out.
You're doing great.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's actually pretty helpful. I'm beginning to get a sense for how Michael sees things. The problem is he's not getting any sense for how I see things. When do I get to tell my side of the story?
Well, you've done a lot of good listening. Michael might be in a better place to start listening to you. Give it a try.
From my point of view, Michael, the problem was that I did this favor for you, and then you mistreated me. You acted badly.
Cut. Cut, cut. Okay, yes, you do want to move to your perspective, but first you need a transition sentence. Something that acknowledges that you're beginning to understand his view on this, and that you want to now share yours. And when you do share yours, if you want to share feelings, share feelings. But what you said is a judgment about Michael, which is rarely helpful. It's better just to say how you feel.
I'm beginning to get a sense for how you're seeing things, and that's really helpful to me. I also want to try to give you a sense for how I'm seeing things and for how I was feeling.
Okay.
I'm not always good at talking about my feelings, but I'll give it a try. I felt hurt by some of the things that you said.
Jack, I wasn't trying to hurt you. I just needed the brochure done right. Sometimes I think you're too sensitive.
Cut. Okay. After all the listening I did, now he's gone and interrupted me right off the bat. I didn't even get a chance to get the first sentence out. That's how Michael is. He always interrupts, and I can never get what I think on the table.
This is where you have to be persistent, a little more assertive in getting your story out there. You can interrupt him to create space for what you're trying to say, and you just need to be very explicit that you're still explaining your view, and you'd like him to listen.
Okay. Well, hang on a second. Before we get into how you feel about how I feel, I just want to get out how I'm seeing things.
That's fine, but what I'm saying is that you're taking this question of our business interactions too personally.
He did it again. See? That's what he does.
Well, he is good at interrupting. So how are you feeling at this point?
I'm feeling really frustrated.
So I think you have a few choices here. You could give up, but I think it's way too early for that. You could do some more listening, and that's always a good idea. But let's say you don't want to do that at the moment. Instead, you could try two other things. One is, you could simply reassert that you want to get your view on the table, and I suspect that that would eventually work. A second is that you could share your frustration at being interrupted.
If I do that, he'll interrupt to tell me I shouldn't be frustrated. I think I'll just try once more to be assertive. Michael, I understand that you think I'm taking things too personally. We can come to that, but before we do, I want to give you a better sense of where I'm at.
Brilliant. That was great. You started with listening and paraphrasing his sense that you take things too personally. For him, it helps take away the need to keep saying it. And now you're in a really good place to continue your story.
Okay, I think I'm getting the hang of it. So bear with me. Here's the thing. When you called, here's what I was thinking to myself. You know, I'm incredibly overloaded at the moment. I need to get the Anders materials out by tomorrow. I'm supposed to have dinner with Charlotte tonight. And then I thought, well, I'm just going to have to call the Anders people and let them know their stuff will be a day late, and I'll have to call Charlotte and cancel dinner. Because, Michael, you sounded like it was an emergency, and I really wanted to help you out.
And I appreciated that. That's why...
But you didn't say it. From my point of view, after making these sacrifices, the first feedback I hear is, gee, Jack, you really screwed this one up. Can you see why I would be upset by that?
I shouldn't have said that, Jack. I meant to say thank you. I guess I was overloaded with my own frustrations at that point. It's interesting. I wasn't thinking that you were doing me a favor, to be honest, although I can see now that you were. What I was thinking, and what I still think, is that also I was doing you a favor. You know, giving you the business. There were other people I could have called, but I thought you'd appreciate the business.
Which I did. I guess on my end, I was so caught up in just trying to get everything done that it wasn't feeling like a favor from you. But obviously, I really do appreciate the business. Hey, this is kind of getting fun.
You're doing a great job. Just keep going.
Jack, I still want to talk to you about something else. If we're putting all our cards on the table, I get really upset when you try to deny that you've done something wrong. You know, you say that the chart is fine when it's not.
Okay, it's getting less fun again.
Well, that's how difficult conversations are. They go up and down. You just got to keep working at it.
Okay. Michael, I wasn't denying anything. I didn't do anything wrong.
Okay, hold on. Let's slow down. You're at a very tricky point here, and there's the potential either to get into a big argument or to straighten things out in a very helpful way.
I believe you, but I'm not seeing it.
Let's think back to what Michael said. He said he gets really upset when you try to deny that you've done something wrong. He's making one of the big mistakes around impact and intentions, and you're making the other one. In Michael's statement, he's assuming he knows what you were trying to do. You know, what your intention is.
Which he doesn't.
Right. So he's making the mistake of assuming he knows what your intentions are when he doesn't. When we do that in conversations, it creates exactly what's happened here, which is that the other person defends themselves and you get into a pointless argument.
How can I not defend myself?
The best way to handle confusion around impact and intent isn't to defend yourself. First, you have to acknowledge the other person's feelings, and only then should you try to clarify what your intentions were.
I hear that my response was frustrating for you.
It was. I'm not trying to be a bad guy. I'm just trying to get it done right.
Let me try to explain my response. I wasn't trying to pretend nothing was wrong or trying to put one over on you. I genuinely felt that the chart was fine the way it was. As we've talked about it, I see that my reaction wasn't based on all the information. I'm not sure what I think about the chart at this point. What I do know is that if I thought it should be redone, I'd be the first to admit it.
I don't know about that. I still get the sense that you're sometimes defensive around making mistakes.
No, that's not true.
Okay, you did a great job of sorting through the intentions question. It's not easy. Now we're getting into another tricky area. Is it true, in your heart of hearts, that you have no problem with mistakes?
Of course not. I hate making mistakes. I can't stand it. It makes me crazy when I make a mistake, especially a stupid one.
Well, so why'd you say you have no problem with them?
I guess I don't want to admit that I do have a little bit of trouble around owning up to mistakes.
Here's the thing. Michael, for one reason or another, senses that you have issues around making mistakes. You might do better by sharing some of your identity conversation with Michael. It is a risk, but in this case, not a very big one, since he seems to already know it.
Actually, Michael, as I think about it, admitting mistakes is something that I do have trouble with sometimes. Even just admitting that is hard for me.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. I really wish you'd just admit them, and then we can get on to the work of correcting them.
Well, I don't want to confuse two issues here. I did make a mistake with the chart, and it was my strong judgment, at least at the time we were talking, that the problem was so inconsequential that we didn't need to redo it.
Fabulous. You owned up to the real issue you have, and you also did a great job of using the and stance to clarify that in this case, you felt like you were using good judgment.
So what's next for me? Are we almost done?
You're getting there. What else feels important to you to say? What else feels important to learn?
Well, we've talked about what I did wrong on the brochure, but we haven't talked at all about what Michael did wrong. After all, he reviewed it, and he gave me the go-ahead.
That's an important issue. See if you can bring it up as an issue of joint contribution rather than blame.
Michael, there's another issue I want to bring up with you. I get the sense that you're thinking the fact that the brochure was off was entirely my doing.
Check, let's not get into that again. I'm not trying to beat you over the head with it. I understand that you worked hard on the brochure, and I appreciate that.
I know. I just want to offer a different angle on this blame question. Your reaction was that since I did the work, the chart was my fault. And my initial reaction was that since you looked it over and gave it the go-ahead, that it was your fault.
No, I never said I proofread it. That was your job. What I indicated was that assuming there were no mistakes, it was okay for you to print.
Well, that's just my point. What I'm saying is we both had a hand in the problem. We misunderstood each other. I'm not saying there's a right or a wrong. If we just...
That's certainly true, but so what?
The point is, we're more likely to avoid this kind of problem in the future if we're more careful to communicate clearly. I should have asked you point blank whether you'd read the brochure carefully, and you might have said more clearly that you hadn't. Either one of those things would have been useful, and would be useful to do next time.
I think that makes sense.
Whoa, that was much easier than talking about blame, and much more helpful, I think.
And notice that talking about contribution focuses you naturally on problem solving. So let's work a little more on that. You each have your own view on whether the brochure should have been redone. Why don't we do a little problem solving on that issue?
The fifth step in having a difficult conversation is problem solving.
Michael, let's think about how we should handle a difference of judgment if it happens again in the future. For example, whether the brochure needs to be redone.
I think as the client in this situation, we should just do it my way. I don't see it as some sort of joint decision.
I agree in terms of the final decision. You should definitely make it in that case. I guess I'm wondering how to give you the benefit of my judgment before the decision is made. I can imagine there'll be times when you have a certain view and then we'll talk about it and you change your mind.
That's true. So maybe if we're more clear about what the purpose of the conversation is, then instead of thinking you're trying to make the final decision, I'll know that you're just giving me your opinion.
That makes sense.
But sometimes I don't have time to have a long conversation about it.
I understand that, and it would be helpful if you'd tell me that. Otherwise, I don't understand why you're getting so frustrated in the conversation.
So I can just say, I don't have time to talk about it?
Yeah, and also tell me why. That you've got to get something out by noon, or that this revenue issue is a touchy one, or that we can talk about it later. It'll only take 5 seconds, and it'll save me from getting frustrated with you for not listening.
I can see why that would be frustrating.
Jack, you and Michael are on your way. Nice job.
As long as I'm on a roll, I want to bring up with Michael the thing that in some ways is the most difficult, and that's this question about our friendship. I want to make sure that none of this has hurt our friendship.
Well, check your purposes on that. Making sure that none of this has hurt our friendship sounds like you're going to put words in his mouth. It's a little controlling. If you're going to ask a question, make sure it's an open question. Just ask him how he's feeling about your friendship. If the problem did hurt your friendship, you want him to be open to saying so.
I'm glad we're working through these issues. I think it's really hard to work with friends. I guess I wonder whether you think this has affected our friendship.
Well, what's your answer to that question?
Honestly, now that we've talked it through, I feel much better about things. Before we talked about it, I was pretty angry, and probably a little hurt, too. If we hadn't discussed this at some point, it would have been easy for me to figure that we just weren't going to stay friends.
I'm surprised by that. You and I certainly react differently to this kind of thing. I wasn't happy with our working relationship, but I thought our friendship was fine. I view them as separate. But since you obviously think about it differently, I'm glad we talked about it.
Looks like we're friends again.
You handled it really skillfully.
Thanks. I suspect we won't have these sorts of problems in the future.
Well, I don't know about that. In fact, I think maybe you're better off assuming that you will. But now you know that it's okay to talk about them. So the misunderstandings may not be as emotionally draining, and they're less likely to threaten the relationship.
As the saying goes, life is just one damn thing after another. It is, of course. And now you have some skills to handle it.
We hope you've enjoyed this production of Difficult Conversations by Douglas Stone, Bruce Patton, and Sheila Heen. This program was produced and directed by John Wager. Music by John Wager. Abridgment by David Rosaller. Production copyright, 1999, Random House Incorporated, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.